Welcome to the Digging Deep podcast, where we offer bereavement bites for time-pressed professionals. I'm Heather Kightley, the president and CEO of GFD. Today on our podcast, we are airing a recording of our panel discussion held at our Greenside Up event, where we will be discussing current challenges and opportunities for Ontario cemeteries.
Well, I would say a few things. So, of course, in the GTA, the land issue is astronomical. Obviously, it's number one on everybody's mind. Moving out of the city, it's not, top of mind. But the real heart of the issue is the fact that, going back to what this gentleman said, municipalities don't want more cemeteries. They aren't allocating land for cemeteries when they're doing any kind of planning. When they're building, 5,000 houses, they're not thinking about where those 10,000, 20,000 people that are occupying those 5,000, houses are going to be in another, 50, 60 years. Well, everybody's going to die. All the citizens, of your area are eventually going to die. And where are they going to go? Is there going to be space for them? So a lot of it goes back to a severe lack of planning and a lack of wanting cemeteries, even in municipalities. And I would say, in terms of the rural cemeteries, a lot of us, don't have the funds to expand, to buy the property. So, when that lot, acreage of farmland or property goes up for sale beside your cemetery, most of us can't afford to put the dollars behind buying that property. So it's going to go to a land developer, and it's also going to be backed by the municipality because, again, taxes, those become taxes, houses taxes. And taxes, exactly. So it's more of a complicated issue than just being in the GTA.
Politicians only have to think 5, 10, 15 years out. Cemeteries have to think out 100 and forever. And you can't convince them because, hey, if I get my 15 years in, I'm out of here, it's someone else's problem. And the same with the people that actually work in the municipalities. 20 years, I'm out on pension. So, we just push it down the road, like you said.
Is there some NIMBYism going on here? We need cemeteries, but certainly not in my backyard.
Absolutely.
We want it to put it somewhere else.
I don't know. The townhouses that are being built about 6 feet from the property line from Woodlawn, I don't think they care about it. I would have thought there was not in my backyard, but they've got that development's 100 condos, and 45% of them are sold right now. So I think to myself, they're moving in, and they're like me. They probably walked in the morning, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, walked my dog out before I came here this morning. It's walking the dog in the cemetery. Beautiful place to walk.
I'll give one other observation and then move on to another topic. I'm in Toronto. My grandparents are buried in the Dawes Road Cemetery. And as I recall, the Dawes Road Cemetery, it's a plot of land, it's dead flat. The cemeteries are laid out row upon row upon row. I live in Maple, near Maple Downs Golf Course, Eagles Nest Golf Course, and the nearest cemetery to me is Pardee Shoal. And if you drive in there, it's rolling hills, it is not flat, there's curved roads. The cemetery is not what I thought of as a kid, which is just row upon row upon row of burials. Is that something that is happening now? I don't want to say it's more inviting. That's not a word I would ever use about cemeteries, but it is certainly, it has a very different feel to it than what I would have said are the old traditional cemeteries. Is that something that's happening? They're trying to make cemeteries.
How old is Dodge Road?
Oh my goodness, it goes back 100 years.
Yeah, still fairly new. If you go to some old cemetery, old sections of local cemeteries, it's going to be very hilly, it's going to be very more like the setting that you were talking about. I think that's a very specific...
Yeah, I guess because it's where it's located in East York, in Toronto.
And I find Jewish cemeteries tend to have that because they're buried one after the
other. Oh, yeah.
It's also based on the school of thought that went in behind the cemetery planning. So Mount Auburn Cemetery in Boston was one of, it was the very first garden-style cemetery. So it involved the kind of the rolling hills and and it planned for kind of meandering walkways and things like that through cemeteries, as opposed to, say, my cemetery, which is, you know, built started in 1865. It was a farmer's field. It is very square.
It's like Uxbridge is a great example. Like it's a union cemetery, right? So it's got your Presbyterian section, your Anglican section, and that was how it was created. You could actually still see the tree lines in those cemeteries. Later, they became amalgamated and became community cemeteries.
Yeah, the Jewish cemeteries are laid out by congregation.
Yes. Yes.
You know, which congregation were you a member of? Yeah. There's where you go. That's the section.
Uxbridge is exactly like that.
I think that's one of the issues coming up, those too, because religions, with different religions, the congregations are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so we used to rely on congregations coming out to our cemeteries. Woodlawn was a union cemetery as well. And we used to rely on that type of stuff. So 100 years ago, when someone passed away, full-size burial, they needed a cemetery. They needed one. Today, when someone passed away, 70% of those people do not require a cemetery because they're being cremated. And so we have to develop, instead of the need, we have to develop a want. And that's what we all should be looking at, is how do we get our cemeteries, how do we develop our cemeteries to be a want? Like someone passed away. One of the things when you say the large community, or large, a lot of houses being built around cemeteries and communities and that, filling in less and less space for cemeteries, those people are new. Like I live in Guelph, a lot of new people from Toronto are coming to Guelph, and every one of those people, well, on a welcome basket, if they're coming in from outside the city, they'll get a welcome basket. And one of my funeral home friends, they're very smart people, funeral directors, one of their funeral friends said that they were putting their advertising into that welcome basket. And I thought, what a great idea. I never did it, but that's what we should be doing as a cemetery, is welcome. They're great. You don't want to wait to use a cemetery until you pass away. You want to get up 5 o'clock in the morning and take your dog for a walk. And I said, that's the want that we need to develop, is what do we have that adds to the community? So the community doesn't say, not in our backyard, they say, we want to be next to a cemetery.
You two have both talked about a trip to Australia. If I was going to Australia, I wouldn't go to a cemetery.
Well, I'll tell you, if you went to Rookwood Cemetery, you would go to Rookwood Cemetery. Over 100 million burials. It was one of the most beautiful places
I've
ever
seen. That's what I was going to ask you. What can we learn from practices from other parts of the world? What is going on elsewhere that we could learn and benefit from?
I think moving to embrace more environmentally friendly technology. When I was in a cemetery in Australia, they were in the process, like a 5-year plan of converting all of their lawn equipment to electric.
Lawn equipment?
Yes. So, lawnmowers, trimmers, leaf blowers.
Right.
That's a long
tractors.
Jump. That's a long jump from the beginning of our cemetery when we had goats.
I've seen some cemeteries actually use goats.
That's a good idea.
It's a great idea. What else? I think using areas in your cemetery that aren't necessarily as nice, using space to create memorialization for people that are scattering loved ones elsewhere, introducing term memorials. So, you know, you have a beautiful, gorgeous tree in your cemetery. Well, everybody wants to stick their name under that tree. Well, before you probably sell it forever, here you go, you can have it forever. Well, introducing 10, 15, you know, 20 year terms. Same with benches and things like that. You know, having renewable sources of income in your cemetery is important.
Is that like selling advertising space on the side of buses?
Exactly.
Paul, what did you learn in Australia?
What did I learn?
Throw a boomerang and drink Fosters.
Good accent. Say party. They know how to party in Australia. I think what I remember in Australia is the Rookwood Cemetery, over a million funerals or burials in the cemetery, all different types of religions. There was one group that owned the road system, and then the religions had different blocks of graves and that. And they were doing a restoration. One of the people I was meeting down there was a former employee of mine who worked for us for about 20 years. Some of them, you might know him in the room, is Satch Killam. And he was a monument restorer. And so when he went to Australia, that's what he ended up doing. So I just enjoyed Australia and the Rookwood. They used to have trains from the train station in Sydney but you have a funeral. There was a funeral home at the train station. They take the train up to the funeral home, and they take the casket all the way up to the cemetery. They had another train station in the cemetery. They had two or three stops in the cemetery. That's how big this cemetery was. And you would take your casket, and then you would take the casket from there to the gravesite. I thought that was cool. Very, very cool. But it's not something that's very, very modern, because now they don't have trains going up there, so things change quite a bit.
I'm going to pause here for a moment and ask if there's any comments that you guys would like to make before we push on. Yes?
I have a comment. We have a St. James West Rock is a very old cemetery, and it what they used to do is just take the southeast corner of a 200-acre farm, and that would be the burial grounds. And the design of that cemetery, because it's so old, is there would be a family plot here, a family of 12 plots, and then next door would be the next family, and there'd be 12 or 10 plots there. And so the cemetery was designed by family plots. And then as new people moved in, they might buy an individual plot or something like that. But no. My great-grandfather, well, actually, I have my great-great-grandfather buried, and then next to him is my great-grandfather, and then my grandfather, and then my uncle. So I can go four or five generations just walking from there to there. And so the design of the cemetery is by huge family plots. And at one time, they used to have high cornerstones and chains around that plot, which made it extremely difficult to maintain. So at some point we had to get rid of those chains just to maintain the property. It's just a different perspective than you're talking about the Jewish cemetery, how it was organized, and some of the other cemeteries, how they're organized.
I think we were talking about this at a table, about how and I think Megan talked a little bit about cemetery design and how cemetery design has changed, and I think that it seems to me from an outsider's perspective that many of the design ideas behind cemeteries, especially older cemeteries, were around aesthetic versus practicality. I don't know if that's something that you've seen in your practice. We were talking, one fellow was talking about a big wrought iron fence that they have to maintain that costs a fair amount of money to maintain and they have to keep, which probably someone thought was going to be an absolutely beautiful thing to have around the cemetery, not necessarily thinking about that idea of aesthetic versus function. And let me ask, I have a room full of cemeterians, so I'm going to ask you guys this question. Is it now where there's more freedom to design moving forward for function, or do you find that you're thinking about function versus aesthetic a little bit more? I'll look at you, Megan. You can kick us off.
Absolutely. We're always looking at our cemetery as not just a cemetery, but a multi-use space, and how people, and how we want people to use the space. Of course, we're always going to be respectful of the fact that this is a burial ground. You know, there's a lot of religious beliefs, a lot of cultural beliefs that we want to respect, but we also want to realize that the most important thing is getting people in the gates of our cemetery, whether that be, you know, through walking, you know, doing different events and things like that. But I always like planning long term. I'm looking at ways that people will want to enjoy the space, not just in the traditional sense of coming to a burial or burying a loved one and never returning. I want them to come back, and I want them to be coming back to do, you know, other types of other activities and things like that.
We're getting close to the end of our time, so if you've got any other questions, please go ahead.
One of the big issues with us, with the small cemetery, is liability. About somebody coming, like, we don't have staff there on a regular basis, so if we have people coming in, there's always a concern with some of the older high stones. The metal rod in the top of the stone has rotted, mm-hmm. and there's an opportunity or a chance for that to fall off. And in fact, some of them have been struck by lightning. And in fact, my uncle, one of them actually fell and hit him on the head. And the other thing is with the uneven ground sometimes. So that's a big issue with us in terms of insurance. Is the main thing is liability of someone coming on the property and falling or some tripping or something like that. So
we had a larger cemetery that was older, and we couldn't do all the graves, fixing all the graves in 1 year. So we started making it sort of we'd concentrate one third to a quarter or so. Every year we'd check that and keep moving around. We'd also check monuments for safety of monuments. If you're out there and have a program that you're trying to keep up with and you're fixing the ones you find, that's better than not doing anything at all. If you ignore the problem and something happens, they'll go and sue. Now, thankfully, we're in Canada, and lawsuits don't get to be the overly big. But I had an elderly gentleman fall into a grave. You know, the casket gave way, no concrete liner. The leg went down, he broke his leg. And his son from Florida got word of all this. And from a lawsuit or a payment, the insurance company would pay him $5,000. And the son won $95,000. And I said to the insurance company, I said, what do we do? And he said, just leave it with us. We'll take care of him because we know how to deal with this problem. And that's all you've got to do is leave it in the hands of your insurance company. But having a proactive program rather than a reactive program, every time someone fell in a grave, you fix it. You want to get ahead of the game a little bit. And as long as you got some kind of program in place, you're protecting yourself to a certain amount. Always have insurance.
I never thought that cemeteries would need liability coverage.
When, you know what? You've learned a lot on the board.
I also wanted to just add to that. You know, if your monuments are really a problem and there isn't enough funds to you know, make those monuments upright, safe, you can always lay them down. And if that is the safest option, if liability is really a concern, if you lay them down and you have no and you've exhausted all other options, laying them down is the best option.
We did that.
Exactly.
We laid down a grave, a limestone, let's say they chipped off, and we laid down, but we didn't bury it. We just laid it down. Yeah. They kept on running over it with lawnmowers, and then they wore out the inscription. But there was one or a few that we actually buried. For some reason, we dug up and we put sod on top of them. And 20 years later, it was recorded that there was a marker there, so he went and grabbed a marker, and he pulled up the sod, and you could read the sod, the inscription on the sod. And then the inscription was perfect. So there are different ways of doing things.
Before we wrap up, yeah, go ahead.
My question is actually to everyone, including the panel, though. And one of the most frequent questions we get as a board is, how do I get rid of the moss that's on my stone?
Careful.
Is there anyone here that has a direct answer, anything that's better than anything?
A nice warm day, nice dry warm day, you soak it with water and just take a brush to it, a nice bristled brush.
Nylon
brush or like a boar bristle, no metal. And it's been the best thing I've found, that it's the simplest.
Spray with water.
If it's polished, you can take a straight blade on a polished one. If it's rock and use a straight blade on the same conditions.
Megan's got a good one.
Yeah, besides just scraping moss off, like if you actually want to clean it or whatever, there's a great product. It's really readily accessible to anybody. You can buy it at Canadian Tire, Home Depot. It's called Wet and Forget. You mix it up with, you can buy it in like 4 liter jugs. It's about $50. You mix it up in a ratio of like 4 to 1 with water and just spray it on the monument and let it sit, and it will actually pull the dirt and everything out of the monument over time. It's meant for granite. It's meant for patios and things like that. Yes, take the moss off and then use the Wet and Forget, and it's
keeps
great.
It up.
Can we totally change direction and talk about the VAO and our submissions? And we sent our submission in, Comtech, Fire, Union, Guaranteed, and all our money and everything laid out. Our accountant went through, and they have a little blurb in our overall statement about what's gone into the care and maintenance.
So funeral directors have been having to do it forever, so you're not alone in that. But one of the things that we're doing at GFD is we're working cooperatively with the BAO to try to find areas that we can make it more efficient for everyone, right? So part of that is, I know Tanya's...
God bless and keep you warm.
What's that?
God bless and keep you warm.
Well, that goes to Tanya. Just very recently, what came out of a meeting with the BAO is that when you transfer your fund to GFD... there's a requirement now that you have to do a confirmation back at the time that it's done. And so we're just going to take care of that for our members. You don't have to worry about it. So as soon as we've transferred it, we get the note from FGP and just send it along. So what, we are actively...
Reason, one more reason to be a member of GFP. I have to put that in my presentation.
Yeah, we're actively, you know, and it's interesting too, because we kind of, when we think about GFD and our values and the why the organization exists. And if you ever come to the GFD office, you're going to see, you come in, you see our values are right on the wall. And in there, it talks about regulators. So we are on a bit of a mission to figure out how can we simplify this whole regulatory process for everyone? How do we make it easier for our especially cemetery members? Because, you know, you just have so little time and there's so many people who are volunteers and there's just so much more work that has to be done. So, and I'm really happy to say that the team at the BAO is very receptive. We had a really great meeting where we just sort of exchanged ideas on how can we get them information so that you don't have to worry about it. Because we have it anyway, right?
Yeah.
And so you may see that there's, you know, check boxes you have to fill out, giving us permission and whatnot, but we're going to do everything in our power to simplify that entire process for the sector, because there's more important things to do with your time.
I think on that note, we'll give Heather the last word. If you want to continue the conversation, I think that would be great. And I'd like to ask you now to thank the panel for their great contribution to this event.
Thank you all.